are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Longtime author Stephanie Dickinson straddles the lines of true crime and memoir in Razor Wire Wilderness. As she examines the lives of those affected by violence in this immaculately assembled account that takes readers directly inside incarceration and face-to-face with inmates. Crystal Riordan watched as her boyfriend beat a teenage Jennifer Moore to death in a vermin-infested New Jersey hotel room. Could she have stopped it, or could she be his next victim? Now Crystal is serving a maximum 30-year sentence, while the man who beat Jennifer to death received only a 50-year sentence. So what does it take to survive in a maximum security lockdown for 30 years? Is it possible to thrive? The answers only lead to more questions in Dickinson's raw and emotional look into the criminal justice system and how it's failed not just one, but countless victims of violence. And what unfolds is a beautiful depiction of moral ambiguity, loss, and redemption within the confines of the prison walls and beyond. The book we're featuring this evening is Razor Wire Wilderness with my guest, author and journalist, Stephanie Dickinson. Welcome to the program and thank you so much for this interview, Stephanie Dickinson.
Thank you so very much for inviting me. It's an honor.
Thank you so much. This is an incredible, unique true crime book. As many people know, the case of Crystal Riordan and her boyfriend, Draymond Coleman, and this brutal murder, and Crystal's role in that as well. Before we talk about this relationship that I just mentioned in the introduction, tell us about your life. You were born in Iowa. You say you're a child of the farm. Your family practiced four square religion. Tell us a little bit about your life in Iowa, who you were, what your early life was like.
Well, I was raised by a single mother after the death of my father. I was 3 years old, and I had two young brothers older than myself, but we were all under the age of six. And after my father's death, we moved back to my grandmother's farm in Iowa. And it's a beautiful farm. I didn't realize how beautiful Iowa was until I left it. But my mother and my grandmother were very, very religious. And so the Bible was our daily bread. It was the most important thing. We went to church twice a week. And my mother and grandmother were very sincere in their belief. And really strong women, and nothing but praise for them. But as a young girl, I rebelled against the strictures of that world. I think we all become very much in our adolescent years and our teenage years. We very much want to see the world, and
right.
When I was 18 years old, I had worked in Canada for a summer at a Christian camp, and I left the camp and I hitchhiked to Montreal. And when I was in Montreal, I met a man named Michael Weston, and we became involved. And I went back to Iowa. But then on Thanksgiving of that year, I hitchhiked down to North Carolina to visit him, and I attended a party. And as described in the book, at that party, there was a really drunk friend of Michael's, and he took out his father's shotgun. And I went to use the bathroom, and just to comb my hair, I couldn't find the light switch, and I sat down on the toilet, not to use the bathroom, but just to sit. And Charlie came into the bathroom, and he had the 12-gauge shotgun balanced on his hip, and he laughed, and the gun went off very, very close to my face. But the doctors had told me, you're alive because you leaned forward. And at that point, I lost consciousness, and I lost the use of my left arm in that bathroom. And it was quite a journey to return, but I did. And 4 months later, I was in college.
And what did you do? You say with this disability here, what did you end up doing?
Well, I got a master's degree, an MFA in creative writing, and as a lot of people are finding out, because MFAs are so popular, it's a hard degree to sell. There's not a lot of ads that want or someone with their MFA. So I took temporary jobs as a word processor, believe it or not, a one-armed word processor, or one useful word processor. And I've supported myself with that in all the years since. And I work for some really large firms, and worked my way up to fairly decent salary. But I've been told by doctors that doesn't sound as unusual as you might think, that I would be I would do word processing. It's that a lot of disabled people will do something that you would think would be outside of their capability of performing it, and there must be something challenging in that, because I've also found that word processing leaves me that mental space to do my writing.
Let's talk about that writing. What were the first opportunities you had to write, and tell us about your writing career.
Well, I've been writing since I went to school at the University of Oregon, and when I came to New York City, I always said that I lived, and now I'm going to write about it. I attended a number of workshops in New York City. I studied with the wonderful William Packard, who developed the New York Quarterly. And I studied at the Writer's Studio with Philip Schultz, who won the Pulitzer a number of years ago, and just learned some really wonderful things, met wonderful writers in the city, and it's just been, that part of my life has just been wonderful. And I even started my own small press, Rain Mountain Press, just out of the love of the thing. To publish books that might the mainstream presses might not be interested in, and to do small print runs. And I started publishing with short story collections. I've done flash fiction and poetry. Poetry's always been a tremendous love of mine. I did write a novel, thinly veiled autobiographical novel called Half Girl, which is about the shooting. And it took many a year to get to that point. I'm speaking about the disability very openly with you, but it took me a long time to be able to even admit that to myself. Because I think when you're 18 years old and you go through something so traumatic that changes your body image, and you're in that age where you want to be attractive, you go through, you know, it takes a lot to come out into the open with that sort of thing. So I published Half Girl, and it won an award. And then I published more short story collections. So with small presses, but nicely published. And so I've just really found that part of my life really quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But when
you
I
talk about, sorry, go ahead.
No, when I approached Krista, which we'll talk about, that is nonfiction, and so that was a bit of a challenge to understand how my more poetry centric world would meld with that more harsh, gritty nonfiction world.
Before we talk about the initial contact that you have with Crystal Riordan in this prison and the questions you ask her and the reason for corresponding with her in the first place, there are some regrets with this Thanksgiving, other than that obviously that you're now disabled, and you go into that in quite detail in the book. But just in general, you have regrets from that Thanksgiving, but you also have regrets about your own behavior. You say that you didn't tell your father that you were hitchhiking to this in five states over for this Thanksgiving Day party, but also your background, it seems, you took a lot, you felt guilty about your behavior and felt some responsibility for what had happened that Thanksgiving Day, didn't you?
I certainly do, and I still do to this day. The hurt I brought my mother, who had a very hard life, and my family has been tremendous, and it took a long time to really embrace that how I hurt myself had incredible ramifications in my family's, in the rest of their lives too. And so many people say it wasn't your fault, but I hitchhiked a long way without telling anyone. I treated my mother badly that way, and I was sexually promiscuous, and that was sort of after being raised in such a religious environment, it was sort of an embracing of that more hedonistic kind of lifestyle, but it was the impulsiveness of that age. And so I have tremendous, a real passionate response to that age and to women who find themselves making impulsive, bad decisions in that window, when you can make a mistake that will last the rest of your life. And to this day, my brothers, still have, feelings about this and emotion about the shooting. So you really don't realize what how your behavior affects other people at that age. Sometimes you just don't care because you're finding yourself. And I look at the way I acted then, and it makes me ashamed. It does. I think I've accepted that, but it's something that doesn't go away.
But very much you realized that your life did turn around, and it wasn't the end of your life as you knew it. It was a new life, and you thrived and persevered and succeeded. When you first, obviously you're a writer, and you also have interest in true crime writing, and you write in this Razor Wire Wilderness that not since Manson were you interested in a case that it's at a point of obsession with the Crystal Riordan case. And in fact, with the tie-in with your writing, you had written a fictional book loosely based on the case called Love Highway. So tell us a little bit about Love Highway before we talk about your first correspondence with Crystal Riordan and why.
When I first saw, Jennifer Moore's face on the cover of the Daily News, she was then considered missing, and she had walked off into the night, 18 years old, and I was just struck because that was that age, that 18, that she had made this mistake, and I read particulars of what had happened, the underage drinking and leaving the club, and she and her friend's car had been taken to the pound. Just series of mistakes that led to her vulnerability. Then the next day, we saw Draymond Coleman on the cover of the Daily News, and then we saw Crystal Riordan's picture. And when I read that there was another woman, a young woman in the room who was there when Jennifer was killed and raped, I just couldn't, I was just, you know, numb or just fixated with that. How could this be? How could someone so close in age to a girl not watch, not run away from the room and call the police? And as more so it was that threesome, that toxic interplay between the three, Coleman and Jennifer and Crystal, but that a girl watched another girl being killed. I felt I really wanted to write about that, or to understand it, to try to grapple with that, because it was so foreign to any way that I think. So a short story led to the novel, which was loosely based on the case. But as I came to know Crystal, I was surprised at how I did come close to some of her characteristics. But it was as I was finishing Love Highway, one of my friends who had read the manuscript said, "Well, why don't you get in touch with Crystal? Why don't you write to her and see if she'll write to you back?" And so I called Endemann Correctional Facility for Women in Clinton, New Jersey, and they gave me her ID number and the address, and I wrote her. And a friend of mine said, "Just ask her, how are you doing? I've been thinking about you." And so that was really kind of the tone in the letter, you know, how are you doing? I've been thinking about you, and introducing myself and a little bit of my history. And she wrote me immediately back and told me that she didn't usually write people back, but that there was something, she could feel some sympathy or something, you know, that in my letters that she responded to. And one of the ground rules was from the beginning, she didn't want to be judged. She'd been right. Judged so many times already that was the one bedrock. I don't want to be judged. And our correspondence began, and it has continued to this day. It's moved into the more email and video chats and the whole and J pages, the whole electronic array that visits are not allowed anymore under the COVID conditions. There were some prior to that, but it's been, I think Crystal has said that she considers me family. And sometimes when you make a commitment to someone and not perfect, and you're not perfect, and you're not taking away the enormity of what was done, but you've made a commitment to this person, and you're going to keep it. So that was the initial contact, and it's been, you know, quite a journey since then. As I didn't realize that knowing Crystal was going to take me into the prison system itself.
We have to talk about this crime for those people that really don't know what was entailed here, but you didn't ask in all of this correspondence, you didn't ask why, when Jennifer was screaming, and we have to get to the details of this, was screaming, did she turn up the TV set? Nor did you ask her, why didn't you try to help Jennifer? So before you endeavored to do this, despite the misadventures and the things that you left your moral compass, you believed, and it led to this event that you could never, that changed you forever, how could you put those things aside? What was it about your background, or what was it about Crystal? Just looking at photos, looking at her mugshot, finding out some details of the crime, despite the headlines, why did you write Crystal Reardon?
I think I wanted to find out who she was. I did want to understand. I thought if I knew who she was, if I knew who she was, then I would understand. I wouldn't have to ask why she did what she did. And I think that if I had asked her, it would have been very difficult for her to tell the truth, if she even knows what that truth is, because we do sculpt memory, and that night was so painful, and the moral ambiguity was so great that I don't know what she would have said, and I have asked some questions, and I've gotten different answers. But I did feel that getting to know her, that I would discover what it had, I would discover why, the why of this. I did reach out my hand, as the years went by, in friendship to her too. Because I do believe that the redemption is possible for all of us, and that we deserve to be looked at as a human being, no matter what has transpired before we met. So those were the reasons I reached out to her. Sometimes I once gave an interview to a television show called For My Man, which I describe in the book. I don't believe it's on anymore, but it was an LA-based show that profiled young women who committed crimes for their men, and they were called ride or die chicks. And the team had come to New Jersey and wanted to do a segment on Crystal, and they could not find anyone who would speak in her behalf. Her parents would not talk. And so they found online, you know, my interest in Love Highway, and I probably had published an essay, and they contacted me and asked me if I would speak for her. And so I did. I went to New Jersey and was interviewed for almost 4 hours for the segment. Very, very lovely and warm interviewer. But I learned things from their investigation. They were able to speak to detectives and police. They had some information very painful to hear for me. And so that was, I had to, there have been some bumps where I've had to think about Crystal caused her to take some actions that, and it was reported in the newspaper the day after the murder that she advertised herself on Craigslist. She was going by the name Lisa then as a prostitute to give the full service for $150, and that was really made a lot of in the newspaper. And here is this young woman who, at the day after a murder, is selling herself on Craigslist. So that added to this whole sheen that this woman is really depraved, I think, in the press.
Mm. When you talk about Crystal and how she got to this point, again, you call it moral ambiguity. We'll talk about more about that. But let's talk about what you found about Crystal's background.
Crystal was born into a home. Her father's Irish and her mother is French. She had two, an older and a younger sister, and they were terribly neglected. The mother worked as a prostitute. The father dealt drugs, they were left alone a lot. They had shared one bed. And they went hungry. And I was so moved by the story that her older sister would go hunt food in the refrigerator. And there wasn't much. But she found canned ravioli and pickles. And so that was their comfort food, in bed, eating cold ravioli and pickles. That was their food. And I found that story so resonant. resonated with me. It just lodged in me. And they had an uncle, their mother's brother, would come over, and he molested Crystal and her younger sister. To this day, Crystal has flashbacks and will hide in the bathroom in the prison, because I think that is where, as a child, they tried to hide from their uncle is in the bathroom.
Right.
When the oldest girl went to school, it was noticed that they had lice and that they were so dirty. And the Child Protective Services came in, and they did take the girls from the home, and they were put into foster care. And they moved around and fought. The sisters were broken up. The older sister went in one car, and Crystal and her younger sister into another. And Crystal and her sister were adopted through the Catholic Charities by a very wealthy Connecticut family who really, really hoped for the best and wanted to make a family. But Crystal's adoptive mother was very strict. Here we run into the four-square religion again. And I think Crystal just needed a mother to just love her unconditionally. And this wasn't going to happen in this home, even though her adopted parents had the best of intentions and created tea parties for their daughters. But it was this strictness and harsh punishment I don't think that Crystal could handle. And she had a lot of screaming in the night, inability to sleep through the night. And when she reached adolescence, and you'll find in the book that she was a role model at a certain point of her life to her friends and their parents. They Crystal was the friendliest, the most beloved girl, and she also became an incredible basketball player because Crystal's very tall. She's 5'9". And in what was junior high, she was already being scouted. So that this is where things started to go wrong, really wrong. She started staying out. She started seeing guys. There's rumors. We don't really know the entire story, but Crystal's mother could not handle this kind of behavior. And she went to a child psychiatrist, and they suggested Crystal being taken to Elon, which is a school in Maine. It's closed now, but it was infamous for its attack therapy and for taking only the most troubled kids from the United States in a very, very isolated Poland Springs, Maine. And they were at the mercy of incredible rules. And Crystal has always said she'd rather be in prison than at Elon. And she spent 4 years there. You would do things like you'd be punished and not be able to go to the bathroom. So you'd sit in a corner and you could not slouch your shoulders. You could not close your eyes because you had people watching you. In the cafeteria, you could not look at a member of the opposite sex, or you would be severely punished. And punishment was gathering the whole group of students, you know, perhaps 100 students, and they would shout and scream at you. So reading, researching Elon, the students became weaponized. And the school itself, the teaching part of the school, took place at night. And it took place for just a few hours in some trailers after 8 o'clock. It just seemed so bizarre to me that the whole day would be spent screaming. And this is quite well documented. And then this very, very small portion of the day, you know, relegated to being taught. And so I think that really hurt Crystal's chances of making a college future. So she was able to leave Elon after 4 years when she was 18 years old. And at 18, she did not want to go to her adoptive parents, and they did offer to send her to college, but she said she wanted her freedom. And she went to live in New York City with another Elon graduate who was a prostitute, working for her boyfriend as a prostitute. And Carrie Ann said, "Crystal, you can stay here, but you have to work too as a prostitute." And that's what started Crystal's sex work. And Draymond happened to be a friend of Carrie Ann's pimp. And he came to the apartment, and Crystal says they had an immediate clicking, an immediate attraction to each other. I said, "Well, what was it about him?" And she said, "Well, he was funny, and he paid so much attention to me, and we just had such a good time together." And I think, too, that he was a lot bigger than her. I mean, she's so tall that there was something about his size that really appealed to her, where it might have frightened other people. And Crystal has said, with kind of a note of pride in her voice, "He fought for me," which means he took Crystal's quote-unquote ownership away from her current pimp and fought for her, and she became his prostitute, his sex worker. And they left the apartment where she was living, and they went and started their vagabond life, living in these hotels, these rent-by-the-week hotels, which were good, according to Crystal, for the work, for the sex work. So this is the trajectory that Crystal was on before the murder. Now, one thing that is in the book, but it was very difficult for me, and I think it will be difficult for readers to understand, Crystal did become pregnant by Draymond. I think she used protection with her.
Right.
You know, but I said, "What happened to the baby? You didn't have her very long." She said she went out to, and the Draymond kept her working through her whole pregnancy. And shortly after the baby was born, she came home from work, and she said that Draymond had signed her away, that the baby was given up to the foster system. And
right.
People have asked me a question that, you know, saying, well, her signature would have been required to, but so that's another one of those real pockets of question and mysteriousness.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity, Stephanie, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. If you're a business owner who's hiring, you probably face a lot of challenges when it comes to finding the right person for your role, like not enough applicants with the right skills or experience, or too many resumes to sort through, yet you need to hire as soon as possible, or not knowing where to post your job to reach the right people. That's why hiring can feel like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job sites with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. In fact, ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. It's no wonder over 2.3 million businesses have come to ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. So while other companies overwhelm you with way too many options, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Once again, remember to go to this unique place, ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we just spoke about Crystal's trajectory into this life, turning tricks in these rent for a week, seedy, very filthy, dirty, seedy, disgusting hotels and motels to do this sex work. You say that the biggest disappointment, she had this child, and one day she came home and he had given the child to foster care. You say she stopped feeling and caring around that time. Tell us what happens just previous to this July 26, 2006, and how on earth Crystal comes to be part of this incredibly horrifying murder.
I think Crystal was considering leaving him. At least some part of her was considering leaving him. There were reports by escort services that she worked for that she was frightened of Draymond, that they never saw Crystal smile, that he would call constantly about the money. And so that was testified to by, you know, third parties, that she was just visibly afraid of him. And she said that she once tried to hang herself, and that Draymond found her, and he cut her down, and then he punched her. And I think if that happened, it would be that Crystal is his moneymaker, and she belongs to him, and she cannot damage his inventory. So that would be that impulse there to punch her after this really self-destructive act. And so they were having problems right before this July evening. Draymond was said to, was reported saying he only liked women who were prostitutes. He also was obsessed by threesomes. And people who lived in the hotel, the latest hotel, were saying that he constantly asked men if they knew anyone that would have threesomes. And Crystal was reported to have said she wanted him to get it out of his system. And that was really naivete on her part, in a way that things don't leave your system like that. They don't. That's kind of wishful thinking. We all think wishfully at times, but it was at this point in their life that the murder were leading up to that July night. That things were unsettled between them, and he was becoming more violent, and so she would have to make some decisions there. She did tell me, she said, "I loved him so much, I didn't think I could live without him." And she said, "I know I was weak-minded. I'm really trying to change that, but that was." You know, what she expressed to me on more than one occasion, how much she loved him. And so it's now July, Draymond has been gone all night. Crystal's worked all night. Draymond comes in, it's almost dawn. He doesn't even have cab fare. He has Jennifer with him, but he doesn't have cab fare, so he has to come up and get Crystal so she can pay the cab. And they had an argument on the stairs because Crystal now knows he has Jennifer with him, and she tells him, "I'm going to leave you." Right. Whether she meant it or not, but she did tell him that, and that also made him very visibly angry. But just to back up just a little, Jennifer and her friend had come out of a club, the guest house, and discovered the car had been towed. The girls went to the guest house, and the towpound refused to release the car because the girls were visibly drunk. And Jennifer's friend passed out. She was so upset, so intoxicated. She passed out, and an ambulance was called, and she was taken to the hospital. And Jennifer, perhaps thinking she was going to be arrested because she was underage, walked out of the towpound lot and walked towards West Side Highway in Manhattan, which is a very frightening place for a young girl who doesn't even have her bag with her because that's locked in the car. She only has her cell phone with her, and it's running down on it needs to be charged. And so she's walking. It's still dark, and someone is following her, and it's Draymond Coleman. And she has enough power in her phone to call her boyfriend in Harrington Park, and she says, a man is following me. He won't stop, and he's offering me drugs. And, of course, her boyfriend said, find a cab. Get into a cab. Come here. Go to your father's. We'll pay, you know. But that's the last phone. That's the last Jennifer's communication with anyone besides Crystal and Draymond and before her death. So we don't know how Draymond talked Jennifer into the cab with him. I did ask Crystal that, and she said he could be charming when he wants to be. Now, I don't know how charming he could be if she was already frightened of him following her, but she did get into the cab with him, and they went to Weehawken, to the Park Avenue Hotel, which was definitely not Park Avenue. It was a really seedy hotel, where a lot of drug dealers and sex workers worked and lived, and the bathrooms were shared bathrooms in the hallway. So you get the picture. And it was here that Draymond convinced Jennifer that he had a charger in the room, and she could come and charge her phone, and then she could call and she could leave. And she was so inebriated that there is footage that shows Draymond almost carrying her up the stairs and into the room. So there we are. And Crystal goes into the room and joins them. I don't know if Crystal thought, okay, here's Draymond bringing another girl. He wants a threesome. This is what it's going to be. But surely then, once the door closed, you knew that Jennifer wanted nothing to do with Draymond or a threesome. She wanted out of that room, and she wanted to get home. And that's when the violence started. He began to hit her. And Crystal left the room and went into the hallway bathroom, the shared bathroom, and she stayed there for quite some time. When she came back into the room, he was strangling her. And I don't know in what, you know, the bludgeoning and the screaming, and Crystal turned up the television. And the reports were that Draymond bludgeoned Jennifer so badly that her eyes swelled shut. She could no longer see, and that he broke so many bones in her face. And that was another detail that I just have not been able to forget or stop thinking of almost every day, because my face was part of being shot, and I know how delicate it is and how important a girl's face is. And for him to just bludgeon that face, this beautiful face of Jennifer's, is really a terrifying thought. She scratched Draymond. She fought. She was a soccer player. I was the captain of the soccer team, and she fought and scratched him incredibly deeply, and that perhaps made him madder. I think Crystal left the room again. This is on the hotel video camera. And she goes downstairs and she buys a Coke. And that this truly went against her in the penalty phase of the trial. But when she went back to the room, Jennifer was almost lifeless. And he goes, "I'm doing this to Crystal because I love you." And this twisted, hideous profession of love for Crystal. So he's doing this to this 18-year-old girl. So I don't want to. And at that point, and this is something that Crystal told her friend Lucy in prison. I don't know the accuracy of it, but Crystal said, after Jennifer was dead, that is when Draymond raped her. And it was the most disgusting thing that she'd ever seen. So you have this split. This is what you've seen. And you can leave. But you stay, and then you help Draymond clean her and cut her fingernails off and take her pulse. And so that was, it was grim beyond belief. And she was put into a suitcase or a canvas bag, I'm not sure, and carried to a dumpster in New Jersey, and put in the dumpster. And then Draymond and Crystal left the hotel. They went to another, like, rent by the week motel in Harlem. And in the cab there, Draymond had Jennifer's cell phone. He made a call to his mother. And this was how they were immediately caught. Mm-hmm. So they're in Harlem, and Draymond goes out to buy pot or weed, and Crystal's alone, and that's when the police come, and she's arrested. And shortly after, Draymond is arrested. And she undergoes 14 hours of interrogation. She immediately tells the police everything. And then she takes them to New Jersey and shows them where the body is. I don't know if she thought that would absolve her from responsibility for certain actions, but it doesn't really. So this is the grim and gruesome story of what happened. And of course, there's so many details you don't know, exactly what happened, or people kind of change their stories. But it was, the police said it was the filthiest room that they'd ever gone into. It was very, very grim. So that is what you have to understand then to know Crystal. And yet, she said, I am a good person. And she said it to me many times. And I believe that. I believe that there is goodness in her, a lot of goodness. And she could not break away from Draymond in that moment. And I also think 4 years at Elon, where you're passive and watching all this attack therapy, which is just so incredibly violent, that calloused her in some way, or made her passive when something so horrific is going on. So that...
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, Stephanie, for these messages. Now, you talked about that's how Crystal Reardon came to be in prison, and you say that she stayed in the county jail for almost 4 years. Mm-hmm. In 2010, this trial finally came to fruition, and then Draymond Coleman looked for a plea agreement, this noble guy that she loved, and he had to put it on her and said that she also had sex with Jennifer, just to add to the salaciousness and horror of this story already. She's already called the Jen Slay hooker, but this is much worse for her, what he does say, doesn't he?
You know, I don't think, and I have told her certain things, I don't think she can accept that he did these things, that he told the police he had sex with Jennifer, and she didn't, according to her, and I believe her there. She's pretty straightforward about that, the sexual aspects of her life. But I don't think she would believe that he would testify against her. And that he took this plea and pled guilty, and then she pled guilty. And she could have, you know, I do think she could have gotten a much, you know, even after she turned down the plea agreement, she could have got a much reduced sentence if she pled the Stockholm Syndrome or the extenuating circumstances were more closely looked at. But he gave her up. He's promised her throughout the years that he's going to write it all up, and he's going to give his testimony that she had nothing to do with it. It was all him. And she, every time he says that, she's hopeful, or she thinks he'll do it. And so that's this magical thinking that regards Draymond in that light. I don't see her having that magical thinking about other people or other situations in prison, but she does about him. He's going to come through someday. And she says, I know I shouldn't. She doesn't communicate with him much, but when he does write her, then she will respond to him. And she said, I know I shouldn't. I know I shouldn't. It's very, very weak of me, but he has no one else. And
yeah,
that's not really true. You know, he does. He's got a mother, and but really, she is the one person that really did profoundly love him. So that is true. Her friend Lucy, who I write about in Razor Wire Wilderness too, has nothing but contempt for Draymond, and really, really believes that he was totally responsible for what went on in there, and that her fear of Draymond prevented her from taking the action that she should have. So, you know, as regards Draymond, that's kind of a, it's not ambiguous there. He was really did monstrous things.
You take us into a place called Maximum Compound, which is, as it sounds, maximum security at the EMCF, Clinton, New Jersey. So this is the Edna Mahan Correctional Facility, 2 hours ride from Manhattan. You talk about her life in there, and you share your thoughts and your information and your background, and she has shared hers, and that's where we get this profound information about her horrific background. But you talk about life and how Crystal lives and how she survives in this maximum compound. Tell us about some of the life in this place.
Well, it's very, very regimented as far as you have a schedule, and you must get up in the morning at a certain time that the lights flare on. You're not in cells, you're in wings and units, but you share, for instance, a sink with five other women and one shower and one toilet. So you're massed on top of each other trying to get yourself clean before breakfast is called. And there are three counts a day where everyone lines up and there's no speaking during the count. Everyone has to be accounted for. And so that takes about 20 minutes. So you've got that kind of structuring your day. The meals are, you won't see fresh fruit, you won't see fresh vegetables. You know, they are in industrial kind of food. If the chicken casserole is on the menu, there won't be any chicken in it because the inmates working in the kitchen will have gotten there first. But I learned so much about how the inmates take Tupperware with them to the meals so they could pick out those things they can use to cook with. There's one microwave in the MCF. It's one of the last remaining microwaves in the New Jersey prison system. But they make incredible use of it. They take milk or they take sugar packets or just little things, you know, from the meal that they can mix with commissary items and make some kind of better tasting food. So, and there's so little time given for them to eat. You know, they're told to get moving almost as soon as they sit down. And then you have the medication call. And if you take medication, if you don't hear that call, you are out of luck for that day. So because the corrections officers, some are really good people, and some, you know, really look down upon the inmates as subhuman, as not worthy of treatment like a human being. So that's going on all the time. Each inmate has a job, or they're going to school. One of the two things. So after breakfast and after the count, you go to your job, and you do receive state pay for that. Sometimes just minimal amounts of money, and that goes into your commissary account. And everything, this was interesting for me to find out, everything costs money. You have to buy all your hygiene products. You have to buy your toilet paper. You have to buy everything runs through that commissary. And so the desire for people on the outside to help with money is always there. And you can understand why, even though these commissary items are very much reduced in price. For the inmates making $40 a month, they are very pricey, and that kind of leads to, and of course, everything on the commissary list, while some of it's good tasting, like candy bars and snacks and desserts, it's all really high in sodium and sugar, and so a lot of the inmates gain a lot of weight, and there's an unhealthiness to a lot of the women. Because of their diet's so awful, and that leads you to the medical portion of the prisons is truly a disgrace to our country. You have to fill out these forms, and which isn't a bad thing, but the inmates are often not even believed that they're ill. They're accused of taking it, and so, for instance, Lucy had a lump under her arm, which turned out to be cancerous, and she had to get outside her family to call administrators to get her looked at in the medical unit. So you've got a real need for something better with the medical system there, and Lucy told me that there was a veterinarian that practiced for years at EMCF as the medical doctor, and when that was discovered, he was arrested. But to think that would be the kind of operation that you would have is really, really suspect. So there's a lot of life and love in the prison, and I do go into Crystal's relationships with different girls, different women, and there's very oftentimes very passionate, and friendships are very, very passionate. I often wondered, you know, on the outside, we're sort of spoiled by all the things we get to watch, Netflix constantly, and there's so much to read and just everything coming at us that we often neglect the people that are most important to us. And I noticed that in prison, there's a real focus because there's not a lot else on your friendships, on other people. I mean, and I've never heard the word love so much as seeing emails between inmates. I love you, I miss you, you know, just friends. And so there's just a lot of affection there too. And there is also, you know, fighting too. I mean, is part of the prison situation, I think. But of course, in the women's prison is not quite as, you know, as dangerous as in the men's prisons. But I think Crystal has really done, she's navigated the prison system pretty well. She's very well liked, has a lot of friends, and liked by staff and other inmates alike. So she...
You talk about the violence
well
in there.
Too.
You mentioned the violence in. Oh, you write about the violence, and I was surprised at the level of violence. I don't know why I was surprised. Maybe because I think women's prison is going to be different, and it doesn't seem to be different. Except, obviously, there's different characteristics, and this quest for love has got to be much different than a male prison. But it's interesting the camaraderie, and you detail the relationship with this Lucy Weems. They are very close. They become great friends. And this is part of how she navigates this time in prison and how she heals herself and becomes a different person is through the help, like you say, the camaraderie, the friendship, the love that she has, that she finds in prison. But also that your relationship with Lucy and with Crystal and the things that you provide them, the little things that they can't get otherwise, but also the things that intangible things that you provide for Crystal, for Lucy, but for Crystal especially in this situation.
Well, you know, people say that when an outside person befriends an inmate, that they get weary, that it's very strong for a while. And then the person drops off because life moves and there's some kind of stasis that goes on with people in prison. They're there, even though they too have life that's very active, but it doesn't seem that way maybe for the outsider. Or the inmate has needs and they'll always have these needs, and I guess some people get weary of it, but I've hung in there, and I think that has been really helpful to Crystal, that she knows that she has someone that's a go-to guy that is there for her. And beautifully, I had published one of the essays that eventually found its way into the book on an online journal, and a photograph that's in the book of Crystal's basketball team was seen by one of the other girls pictured there. And they showed it to one of the women's mothers. And she has written Crystal and is really interested in Crystal's life. She said she loved Crystal as an adolescent. She just couldn't imagine the girl she knew in this situation, but she is reconnected with Crystal, and that's just been a real positive thing. So that's also something that kind of came through, you know, my interest in her and my wanting to share her story with a larger group of people. And I think that's meaningful to Crystal too. I think, you know, I was very worried that, you know, I don't pull a lot of punches in the book. I mean, and that it's not victim, I'm I'm not portraying Crystal as a victim in all cases. I'm not. She's a human being, and she has made mistakes, and she's presented both ways. She's presented that way, and I have been worried about her response to some of that. But I think we've talked about it, and I think she understands that. It just has to be that way, or there's no reason to write a book that wants to get inside someone.
Mm-hmm. You write that for some, Crystal can never repay the debt she incurred in that hotel room. But your own experience with impulsiveness and bad judgment has shown you life sometimes does give us a second chance, and we must seize it. Cannot abandon our former selves, but we can go beyond them. Do you believe that Crystal, well, she will be released one day. Do you believe that she has successfully done that? That she has taken this opportunity and go beyond this horrific crime and this horrific event and this horrific time in her life?
I do. I have high hopes for her. But what frightens me, or what I have some misgivings about, is the length of how long she's been institutionalized. She was 4 years at Elon, and now she's going into her 16th year of incarceration. And so that structure that incarceration or these institutional settings give you kind of takes away some of your free will, which I think was part of the reason she froze in that room. And so that I do worry about. Is she going to be able to handle all the choices, all the structurelessness of our lives, you know? And she will need help, you know, and her new friend is going to really help her, and I'll help her. And there are a lot of halfway houses, and there's a lot of programs now for parolees or people being released from prison. And if she avails herself of some kind of bridging structure, you know, I do think that she has kindness in her heart. I think she wants a relationship with someone who really loves her, and I think she's had some disappointments at EMCF and some really longer lasting relationships. So I do have high hopes, but I have some reservations, like I just expressed, about the structurelessness. It's going to be quite a sea change when she's released. Yeah.
How many years does she have before her scheduled release?
Well, that's the 85% rule. So she was sentenced to 30 years, but had to serve 85% of the sentence. Doesn't have to serve all 30 years. And so when she's released, she has, I think, 6 more years. She'll be released into a halfway house. And she will not be on parole once she's served that 85%. That is considered sentence served. Now Lucy is out on parole. She was paroled. She didn't serve the 85% of her time, but Crystal will serve that time. And the 85% rule unfortunately applies to Draymond too. I think I've calculated it, and I don't think that he could possibly get out until he's almost 80. But Crystal will be in her 40s. I think, you know, she will have a good portion of her youth will be gone. And, you know, I think that she does understand what she did. And she's, I know what I did was wrong. And that would be helping Draymond clean the body and cover up the crime and not going for Jennifer's help. So, I have high, high hopes, and she has availed herself of, she is working on her associate degree. She's done quite well, very well in her college classes. She loves poetry. She has a kindness. She truly does. I've never heard her speak badly about other people, which I think is, you know, her adoptive mother, yes, and certain people. But I've never really heard, she loves her adopted mother too, very much. The relationship isn't real strong, but she treasures what she has of it. But I've never heard her speak badly of people, and that's kind of rare. And so I notice things like that, and I think that bespeaks someone whose heart is pretty good.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable book, and also just regrettably, I guess, the daughter that she gave away, she has been forced to not be in contact with this young woman whatsoever. Just another sad chapter in Crystal Reardon's life. I want to thank you so much, Stephanie, for coming on and talking about Razor Wire Wilderness. It's a remarkable book. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. Stephanie,
oh, thank you. You've just been really wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a great night, and thanks again.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.